This is a work in progress, so I'm even looking for you to help me. Anything you see, from just a bad choice of words to a comma missing or spelling, but the thoughts and how you hear them, especially the non-technical part, and we'll go into the technical, like I said, as much as you would like.
Are we looking at the one you passed out?
Yeah, the one we passed out.
Okay.
The other one, unless you have particular markings, just throw it away. Now, I want to go up to the footnote, so I'll read up to that little number one there, the 16. And then we can also look at the footnotes. But Jerry Cohn, specialist professor in evolutionary genetics and the origin of new species at the University of Chicago, quite a title he has there, interesting, huh? Published Why Evolution is True in 2010. This book is praised for giving an unassailable and airtight case for the truth of evolution with logic and clarity. Although Coyne admits that all scientific theories can be falsified by new evidence and that evolution is a theory, his book embodies the claim that a scientific theory can become a scientific fact or a truth, quote, when so much evidence has accumulated in its favor and there is no decisive evidence against it, then virtually all reasonable people will accept it. And that's from page 16 of the book, and then I have a footnote there. And I'll read that. This is the lighter side here. I'm not even sure what I want to do with this, you know, at the conference, but just a note about this reasonable people accepting it and all the evidence. Polls show that only 40% of Americans believe in evolution, the evolution of man from an earlier species of animal, while 60% hold it to be false or unsure. Coyne even is the one that informed me of that. It's actually 40, 40, 20. 40 believe in it, 40 don't, and 20 aren't sure. So 20 don't add it to the other 40. Yeah. 60 don't embrace it, all right? Now, it seems that Coyne would have us believe that many of his fellow biologists must therefore be unreasonable and irrational. And I don't know if I... Oh, I skipped a line. That's because he notes that many of his colleagues do not know why evolution is true. Many of his colleagues in biology. So they're not reasonable, and they're irrational too, apparently. Just thoughts I'm having here.
But, well, they don't know why, but yeah, they might still believe it.
Yeah, they believe it, but they don't know why. And he's saying all these, the reasons are so clear that everybody should not only believe it, they should see why. That's why he's faulting them. He's saying they should know why, because it's so clear. But anyway, in response, the reader needs to be alert to language like this throughout the book that fallaciously poisons the well. That is about the idea that all reasonable people believe it, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. That fallaciously poisons the well against drinking from the cup offered by anyone who does not believe that naturalistic evolution is true. You know what that's like, the poisoning the well? A guy at the union meeting says, we're going to take a vote now on this particular issue. And anybody who doesn't vote in favor, we're going to take them out behind the barn and shoot them. Now, raise your hand if you vote yay or nay. Well, who's going to want to raise their hand nay? Yeah. They poison the well.
Who wants to be unreasonable, right?
Pardon me?
Who wants to be unreasonable?
Yeah, and who wants to be unreasonable? And dead. Yeah.
Right.
So, now... Okay, the reader needs to be aware of the power of ad hominem attacks on persons instead of issues. You're stupid if you don't believe this and that type of thing. Such attacks are powerful while they contribute nothing to an argument except to render it invalid. Of course, invalid arguments do not justify claims to truth. By contrast, given the reasonableness of most Americans, evolution has clearly not attained facthood, except perhaps in the eyes of the intellectually elite. Well, poisoning aside then, why is it that most people find the arguments for naturalistic evolution unconvincing? Are there serious flaws in the argumentation itself? Well, this critical analysis, my work here, offers an answer to that question by a look at how Coyne uses the evidence he presents, and we want to see if it justifies his claim that evolution is true. And you see, kind of setting up what I'm doing. I don't know. This is in a footnote here, but part of that might be put in the introduction above. Any comments on that now? We're just up to the first paragraph of the paper, but thoughts or?
Yeah, I had a note it's amazing. It's amazing how, I mean, he's very critical of us, but not critical of himself when he says stuff like, "Most reasonable people will see," and you know, just said stuff like that. I mean, it's completely unfruitful. And also, I made a note also his reliance on the inductive principle when he says, "So much evidence is accumulated in his favor, and there's no decisive evidence against it." When he relies on that, I just noted that atheists can't give a justification for why they believe the future is going to be like the past, you know,
right.
But that there are types of things.
Sure. He's probably, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he's not aware philosophically that
yeah.
he has no basis on which to justify the doing of science by induction.
Yeah. Yeah.
We do because God has promised, and so we know the future will be like the past. He promises to hold the seasons together. But they have no basis on which to depend and predict for the future and make do their testing and say, well, tomorrow will be like it, like today.
Yeah.
They go and they reason in a circle.
Right.
Yeah, that fact I am aware of, but it's not part of, I'm kind of taking what he's giving us and evaluating
sure.
it. This would be like a counter. And it is an analyzing, like where he's at in his foundation. That's a very deep presuppositional way of looking at his work and offering a case for Christianity. And I'm not as much offering the case for Christianity, except in part three, when he's constantly attacking Christianity, my responses will be presenting it.
Okay.
Any other? Yes, Tom.
I think it's interesting how he likes to link scientific fact and truth
yes.
together.
Yeah.
You know, where clearly they're very different things. To put them together as if they're one and the same seems a huge mistake.
Yes, and that's why, we're going to go right into that as to why we get into why a philosophical critique is justified here.
Because he's almost delving into the philosophical realm.
He's
like
there
that,
when he mentions truth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know he's got the facts, the data of you know a tool that measures and weighs empirically this or cuts this frog in half and all that. But when he goes to truth, he's moved into claims that use logic and reasoning and laws of thought and things that are outside the range of science.
Yeah,
we'll come back to that.
I have one more comment on what Jonathan just said. Actually, do you think that he's singing to the choir when he makes these claims about science? He tries to press upon us a science, and science brings about fact. Christians don't. We're not against science. You know what I mean? We go to school like other like atheists do, and we observe nature, and we see things. You know, do you think it's an overreaction on his part? Perhaps in part for Christians who kind of argue that way that faith is where where logic leaves off, and you know that sort of thing.
Well, I don't think he understands or appreciates. He doesn't seem to appreciate a Christian worldview that would incorporate science into it.
Sure.
He doesn't really kind of delve that way, but what he does say reveals kind of that's a blank for him.
Yeah.
But he's, you know, using science, I think, in the way, like sort of like this. I mean, look at technology and look at all the advances in medical. You know, who doesn't really respect science?
Yeah.
Well, science, all this data gives you this. How can you not then come to truth? I think he's kind of working like that.
Yeah.
So. Yes.
The quotations, the marks that he has on there, won so much evidence and it has accumulated in its favor, and there is no decisive evidence against it, that virtually all reasonable people will accept it. These quotations are from what?
That's his book. I'm just quoting him. Now, that's page 16. That's what he says on page 16. That's 16 there.
Oh, okay.
Now, the material, the evidence that he says has accumulated, and then the nothing against it, is what he presents in the book. And that book does have a shotgun blast of things. I mean, he presents all kinds of things, from embryology, from biogeography, from DNA studies, and genetics. And his field is genetics. But you know, it's evolutionary genetics. So he's not I don't think he's a researcher or like a person who does the kind of work like someone.
A geneticist.
Yeah, he's
like
not
a real scientist.
like a real scientist. Yeah. Yeah. Good point, because yeah, I want to think that way almost, you know. Yeah.
But you don't want to get in the ad hominem argument.
Right, I want to be careful. But I want to be very respectful and not argue that way. You're into some of the things we're going to address yet. But go ahead, another thought.
But the idea of him calling these things facts, they're more like factoids, aren't they? I mean, things that appear to be facts, and there really is no evidence for them. But he calls them facts.
Well, the facts are the evidence that he's trying. So you have this piece of fossil. You have this piece of this fossil of the Tiktaalik. Right? I think I'm pronouncing it right. Interesting, the Tiktaalik, you know. You have that fossil. Well, that's a fact. I mean, I would say that's a fact. But, you know, how do we arrive at the truth of evolution from
what
that?
What do you read into that?
Yeah. You're ahead of me now, so as you're going like this now, you're starting to open up into the...
Well, I covered this in my second class on academia.
I mean, you know, unless I have you all take over and go down to Cincinnati, I'm going to keep on going here. All right, let's try right after that. Okay, right where I left off with footnote one there. Now, his doctrine of evolution, you see where I'm at? His doctrine of evolution is naturalistic. He sets it, and here's kind of how I'm defending that, because he doesn't call it naturalistic evolution. He says why evolution is true all through the book. But he sets it firmly against the creation of life, offering instead purposeless materialism, page 231, in which, like other animals, we are contingent products of the blind and mindless process of natural selection, page 192, which is the driving force of evolution, pages 10 to 13. The naturalistic theory of evolution has attained facthood to such a degree that all evidence, both old and new, leads ineluctably to the conclusion that evolution is true. Page 19. You just see, he does this over and over again throughout the book. I mean, it's just this kind of language. Of course, giving him the benefit of the doubt, Quine is not being excessively zealous or arrogant. When he repeats his claim of indisputability, affirms certain knowledge, and states the truth of evolution in the title and thus as the heading on every other page of the book. This is facthood akin to sainthood, for my little. Now, of course, or of interest to the members of EPS, Evangelical Philosophical Society, the title of the book directs us away from science to philosophy because Quine claims to be telling us why, I'm going to use any for naturalistic evolution, is true. Naturalistic evolution is a peculiar branch of science that deals with something within unrepeatable history that biologists cannot dissect, observe, or test empirically. You know, empirically, you know, hands-on, touch, taste, you know, empirical testing. So just on that footnote there, unless you have any thought before I say it, but let me go to the footnote 2, the bottom there. When Quine says that we observe, and I'm on the empirical, I picked up on this, so when we observe the development of new species and natural selection today. He is speaking about natural selection regarding adaptations within living species such as hornets, woodpeckers, and mice. And new species, what he's speaking of there, he's speaking of new species that occur in a test tube by removing an enzyme from a complex system that leads to new adaptations. The same holds for viruses that form new species as they evolve, I put that in quotes, you notice, as they evolve in their ability to resist drugs. Here he infers from microevolution to claims about macroevolution. You know, these are, and we'll just call microevolution, things change and adapt. You know, you have to look at all the variety of dogs, or look at the way bears have adapted to cold areas or hot areas. Microevolution. But he moves to from that to macroevolution, which means changing from one species into another over time. This is simply equivocation, which means that accepting the premises regarding what happens in test tubes and environmental adaptation does not logically lead to acceptance of the conclusion that naturalistic evolution is true. I'm going to come back to equivocation. Some of this I'm ahead of myself, even in the footnote, and then I take the material and put it into the body. But for now,
those,
go ahead.
Those are his words, or the field, the science of evolution, that microevolution, macroevolution, right? We don't, as Christians, we wouldn't agree to the use of the word microevolution, even if we agree in principle that there's some adaptation.
Yeah, well,
we
use the term adaptation.
Yeah.
Would you say microevolution occurs?
I think more and more Christians are using the term microevolution, a lot of Christian scientists, meaning adaptation, that there is change and there is development. It's kind of being forced by the conversation. So, I mean, the problem, what I think you're hearing, is when the word evolution is used with micro, it has that ring. But it's very, it's not naturalistic evolutionary theory. Microevolution, and he uses it this way too. Microevolution refers to adaptation within species, living things.
It's like the famous moth thing.
So, those kind of things. Changes a moth in color because of the environment and, you know, woodpeckers or finches' beaks in the Galapagos Islands where Darwin did his work and things like that. Those adaptations are called micro. In other words, they're small. Evolution just means development or change. So you have small changes or adaptations.
So
it's using it. It's okay. Using it, the word evolution in different senses. We got to be aware.
So we don't have to resist as Christians the use of the term micro.
I don't think so. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Bottom line. Okay. As long as we make sure we define it, and I think that Christians and non-Christians are using the term in the same way.
Okay.
As he uses it in the book, I don't really object to how he does it, and I've seen Christians use the same way.
Okay.
So.
I think it's almost a plus for us if we use a microevolution because they think we're coming over to their side.
Yeah, I was thinking that.
But little do they know.
The
plot thickens.
Yeah. All right, that was footnote 2. I hope we're not getting too off the track when we go to the footnotes. We'll just go till a little bit longer, see how you're doing with it all. And if you get too tired of my effort here, we'll rest. But therefore, now I go after footnote 2, therefore, and there you see I was dealing with biologists cannot dissect, observe, or test empirically things that come from history, which is what evolutionary studies are dealing with, something historical. So therefore, conclusions about the truth of naturalistic evolution must be inferential. They're inferences. And this takes us into the domain of philosophy to logic. So I'm in the top of page 2. And log define logic, just in a way. Logic is the branch of philosophy that studies proper versus improper inference making. I'm going real simple, right to the core of things here. Now, unquestionably, justification of the claim that evolution is true goes far beyond, and I say that unquestionably. I don't think I will say that unapologetically. It goes far beyond the facts and data of science. Facts and data tell us nothing in themselves. Information gathered by the tools of science is not self-interpreting. That information requires interpretation, which in turn requires a philosophy of logic. Okay, question or comment, and we'll look at that footnote.
I think most atheists, if not all of them, you know, they boil down the ability to like what is real into two things, and it has to be something that you can see. You know, it's like every fact is kind of like you go and you go look and see if it's there. If you can't do that, then it's not important or it's not real or something like that. But there's so many different types of things. You know, like, you know, you can't go look if a car is in a lot like you would find out about grammar or love or things like that. You know, not everything that you know is found out in the same way. And I think it sounds like Coyne is making that mistake here, you know, by grouping everything into, I just go look and see it, and then I know it's true. Mm-hmm. But really got to deal with the philosophy or the, you know, what the worldview that interprets those things that you're seeing.
Yeah. Trying to think of how to respond to that. I'm disagreeing. I think I'm disagreeing whether, you know, like what he's trying to say. Yeah. I just think the idea when he says why evolution is true, he stepped outside of just the gathering with tools of science.
Yeah.
The why gets into principles of making inferences or logical principles, which are laws, the laws of logic, are laws that he can't measure in a test tube or dissect like he dissects a frog.
Right.
Yeah.
Is empiricism, is that something that's criticized within philosophy?
It is, historically. You know, empiricism would be all the emphasis, be like science is all. Scientists tend to be very empirical, maybe even tend toward being empiricists. Like, all truth comes by empirical hands-on touch and taste. See, there's a claim. Philosophy, that was really a big heyday, like with Bertrand Russell, Why I'm Not a Christian Guy, that type of thinking in the 60s and 70s. He was very popular in the universities. It was called logical positivism, and it was that kind of thing. And it was empiricism, but it's attached with a certain reason. But the empirical is the emphasis. And what philosophy finally did with that is show that that's a self-contradicting claim, because that claim itself can't be tested empirically. So if it's true, it's false. And if it's true, it's false, then it's meaningless. And all those hugely arrogant, these men like Bertrand Russell, they were hugely arrogant men, trying to change philosophy curriculums and everything, or university curriculums all over the world. I mean, these were very powerful men. And then philosophy showed that what they were doing was just a self-contradiction at its most fundamental point. So that was empiricism. And rationalism is on the other side, which is just totally to emphasize the, you know, the thinking, you know.
Is this author, Coyne, like, going up against philosophy, or is he aware that there's this?
I don't know his tension? Exposure. I don't know. Maybe we'll say, if my analysis of his philosophy and of the logical failures or flaws that I see in the book, maybe they tell us that he's unaware. A lot of scientists are unaware of the philosophical foundations of their work. They don't even think that their work depends on things outside of... That's our footnote here. Let's go to that. But their work depends on things outside of their own field. Let me read that. I think I have that in three here. So footnote three at the bottom of two, page two. Scientists depend on many presuppositions that they cannot prove scientifically. Many of them don't know that. They're not aware. For example, the laws of logic cannot be tested and demonstrated by the tools of science, but they must be used by scientists at every stage of their work in defining hypotheses, constructing models, and making inferences. These scientists depend on many other assumptions that they cannot demonstrate, such as the reliability of human sense perception, memory, and the uniformity of nature spatially and temporally over time and throughout space. Why would you? Why they have to assume that principles that they function with on Earth will apply, maybe in various adjustments, but apply like to a rocket or a spaceship or a spacecraft or whatever you call them, taking off from Earth and landing on the moon. I mean, they have to. They're assuming that there's a consistency about data, properties, the behavior, the laws of the properties of matter on the moon in relation to laws of the property of matter on Earth. But they can't prove that. There's no way that they can prove that. They're not omniscient. They can't go all over in the universe. They believe it all through the entire universe. Yeah. The properties of matter are consistent.
But
they can't prove that.
But all reasonable people believe it.
Yeah.
I mean, we put a man on the moon. So they are, at least right now. But you're saying going back in time, is that what you're saying?
Even in the present, that throughout space and over time, which would be past and future, they have to assume something to even do science. They assume it every day to do their science, but they cannot prove it. It's an assumption. It's a presupposition of their work,
yeah.
And knowing that and analyzing that is something outside of their field. And they have to depend on other fields like philosophy to give them that foundation. They have to have theology.
They depend on a Christian worldview secretly.
Yeah,
but don't give God praise for it.
This is a Vantuian way of analyzing that the non-Christian borrows this point, these assumptions from Christianity, even to attack Christianity with it ultimately.
Yeah.
But they have to borrow from Christianity in order to. Let me finish that part, the last half of that footnote. Choices regarding what we count as a fact and how we define factuality itself depend on our worldview. Ultimately, we need a philosophy of philosophy and a philosophy of logic. That is, we need wisdom in how we seek to obtain wisdom in how we do philosophy. We need wisdom in how we discover and use wise principles of reasoning by argument, in how we practice logic. Where we stand on these things will determine the kind of wisdom or folly we apply in our philosophy of science. See, I'm just really saying on there that to do philosophy properly, to do science properly, to do logic properly, you have to be godly. You have to have godly wisdom that I used to develop in all my classes, even at Wayne State on philosophy. I would kind of bring that point up.
If Coyne really believed that finding out something is as simple as going looking at the facts, then they ought to be just everybody in the world that ever lived and who living now and whoever will live, we're all on the same page, you know.
I don't think he believes that, because he does talk about he's gonna get evidence in two ways and we're gonna make inferences. He identifies the fact that he does inferences. I'm just saying, I don't know if he's how conscious he is of what goes into the right principles of inference making, which is underneath. It's a foundation for his work.
Okay.
All right, that was footnote 3. So up there at the top, I finished. We need a philosophy of logic. So let me finish that paragraph up there. Reasonable people can only accept naturalistic evolution if the process of reasoning with the facts and data for it, the reasoning with the data and facts for evolution, is sound. What we need is a sound argument in which we not only have accurate data, but in which we also have validity. I'm using terms technical to, you know, that's a technical way of, we use it every day, but it's a technical term to logic. Validity. Therefore, in this critical analysis, we grant, or will grant, however I want to say that, we grant the accuracy of the relevant scientific facts and data for sake of argument. It's like, say, the billions of years and stuff. I'm not going to be disputing with him on the billions of years stuff. I'll just grant that for sake of argument. And that allows me then to test his philosophical method. So this is kind of telling you what I'm trying to do in the paper. So any comments to that point? We'll look at his evidence. It's twofold where he sets up the evidence next.
Now that's got to be kind of hard because the interpretation is so much a part of the facts for him, right?
Absolutely. And this is why part of it is just to be make him aware, to make anyone aware who's reading the book, to, as I do the critique, make us all aware of this.
Because even billions of years is obviously an interpretation of some geological record,
yes,
or something,
yes.
Right?
And that would be, see, that's just something that I don't, he only has like 3 pages on that, where he does kind of lay it out a little bit, gives a little bit of defense of it. It's not very much. It's more assumed in the book. So as far as I'm concerned, I mean, you know, I'm just going to kind of assume that. I don't see a lot of argument for it there. I don't know if I see any for sure. So he just kind of asserts it. Well, I'll just go with him on that, and I'm going to test his reasoning,
sure,
with the data and facts that he's going to bring up and say, this is why everybody ought to accept that evolution is true. It's just overwhelming.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm doing.
So he's built like a house of cards. You're arguing that philosophy, or arguing correctly, is rightly the foundation of this. So you grant the house. You say you don't even go to the house, but you disrupt the foundation. The whole house of cards falls. Basically, you know, like even
if it's on a bad foundation, the whole thing falls.
Yeah.
So we want to look at that foundation in terms of its. It's logic in terms of how he's reasoning with the facts.
Yeah, okay.
All right, he says that the evolution, or the evidence for evolution, is twofold, pages 17 and 18. He calls it testable predictions and retrodictions, and he defines each, and here's kind of what they mean. The former refers to what we should find in living or ancient species if evolution is true. The latter refers to facts and data that only make sense in light of the theory of evolution. Predictions follow the argument form. Now, this is my analysis. Predictions follow the argument form of conditionals known as modus ponens, and retrodictions use the reductio ad absurdum form of argument. Now, that's a little bit more technical, but let's see if, do you want me to go into that a little bit, or can we just go on? You get the general drift of what I'm doing. You know, the reductio ad absurdum, that's easier to say just like this. It means that you show the absurdity of the opposing position as you prove yours.
You reduce it to?
To an absurdity.
Reduce it to absurdity.
I have to go.
Okay.
Is modus ponens the same as notus tollens? Have I missed a very...
Modus tollens. That's another form of a conditional argument.
Okay.
It has to do with how the argument's working with the parts of the conditional, whether it's the antecedent or the consequent of the conditional.
Right.
So modus ponens is dealing with the antecedent side, and modus tollens is dealing with the consequent side.
Okay.
Just hear it. You know, what I find about things is like, I'm doing this even as I'm reading this guy. I hear things and it just, my mind just goes, you know, like, I stare at the wall, you know, like, and, you know, you go blank. And, well, some of you are doing that right now with modus ponens here. And, but, you know, when you go over it more than once, you hear it, you get the idea. All that is Latin for affirming a part of a conditional. So if we just said, let me just do it real quick like this. I don't even know about this, but if you just said a conditional is if then, so if you say if A, then B, this is the antecedent in the conditional, B is the consequent in a conditional, the antecedent and consequent of a conditional sentence. When they talk about modus ponens in an argument, you're talking about another premise. You have like a premise, and then you have another premise. You're talking about affirming the antecedent. So if someone says, yeah, we have A. Say, if A is the case, and that could be anything. If A is the case, then B is the case. Well, yeah, A is the case. So therefore, so, conclusion, B is the case. That's all this is talking about. And, if it's 32 degrees, then water freezes. It is 32 degrees, so water freezes. This water freezes. If it's 32 degrees around this water, it'll freeze. It is. So it'll freeze. It's frozen, or, you know, it's freezing. That's all it's doing. And he uses his, analyzing his work by seeing that the one type of evidence that he says he's laying out, he works this way. And then another type, he works the way of the reducing to absurdity. Now, guess where he uses the reduced to absurdity way? That's his way against Christianity.
Yeah. And where we would say God created it all, he would attack.
He wants
that.
To show attack that by reducing it to absurdity against the facts that he's discovering. With the data.
But he's not producing, that's what gets me, is they're not producing these facts, the so-called facts, in the laboratory. You know, they're not producing even microscopic parts of these facts that they're assuming are facts. They're not reproducing those in the laboratory so that they could say it is duplicatable in the laboratory.
Yeah, I mean, it's,
I'm saying it kind of clumsily.
Yeah. Well, but because it's history, but they the facts that they have, like, I mean, you really have this Tiktaalik fossil. You really have this this other fossil and that other fossil. And Christians, paleontologists or Christian archaeologists and that, you know, agree that this, yeah, that's a fossil there. That's a fossil. So that's a piece of something that you got to work with.
Sure.
But they're not going to. They don't make something over and over, but they'll do this. They'll, like I said about the what they he says about new species with you take a take an enzyme away from something, and then you see what happens. It does some kind of, it evolves.
Yeah,
it adapts.
Yeah,
and then they do studies of that. So they do. He wants to do. He wants to bring into evolution. It's been a failure in the past. This kind of predictability, if you take that enzyme away, you know, of course he's depending on induction laws, you know, and everything to do it, but so they're trying. He's trying to bring it, make it respectable science, we'll call it, you know. He sometimes talks about how they did it in the past and now how we're doing it better today, you know, stuff like that. But, you know, John, did you have another comment?
Well, just that these arguments that he uses, the
those two, yeah.
And those are perfectly good arguments, right? That even as Christians, we may use to defend a position of our own, right?
Yes.
Not, in and of themselves, they're perfectly good ways to argue logically, right?
Yeah. Testable predictions is something that anybody would do in science.
Yeah.
It's like trial and error in science. And, you know. And so, yeah, I'm not disputing.
You're not pointing them out to say
no, not
these are the arguments he uses, but these aren't good arguments.
No, they're, I'm just trying to get. I'm trying to show from what he's saying about his own way of gathering information. I'm trying to see what he's doing logically from that.
Right.
I'm identifying the logic that's here. It's a he. And then often he'll use then this if then language in his context. So that shows me. Yeah, I see. He's doing this modus ponens, this if-then type of argument.
Okay.
You know.
But your own bias can make you really mess it up at times too, right? You know, if you're
yeah, well, that's why this has got to be public. What I'm doing here, I want to get feedback on what I'm doing. I'm asking the philosophers down at Cincinnati to evaluate my evaluation.
Because
is Coyne going to be there when you?
No.
Oh, you're just critiquing his work.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Not him personally. He won't be there.
No. I can't imagine him attending a theology conference. I mean, it'd be good if he actually said it's at the ETS, and then this is a, you know, the EPS kind of uses the time frame to have their meetings. They're a smaller body of Christians than the ETS, but they always they follow the conferences and they have their meetings at the same time, same places, you know. They do it at the national one too. So, but that's not the kind of thing that this wouldn't be within his range of where he
interest,
walks and
yeah,
where his
yeah.
interest is. You know, it should be because he should know theology a little better
since
he gets into it so much.
Pastor, can I just make one more comment? I'm sorry. In the if A then B, right? When we use the example of water freezing, those are thing. You know, granting uniformity of nature that we can test. You know, we can say we can fill in the blanks with things that we can test and see, like water freezes. We can do these tests. You know, how does he fill in A and B with things that he can't test?
Well, that's what I'll be showing. I'm going to do that.
Okay.
I'll be doing that. I'll show. I get a lot of examples. I think I even have some of them in the stuff that we'll get to next week, and you can read ahead.
Okay.
So I don't want to go too far with this. I want to give it to you in pieces here, but I think I had. At least gotten up to the bottom here of page 2. And I was hoping I could get to that 1, 2, 3 on page 3 here today, but I'll wait. I'll see where you are with me on it. Okay, after footnote 4, I have his argument up in the body there, halfway through the second paragraph up there, the evidence for evolution is twofold, then with a little number 4. Now, his argument structure. Now, here's my analysis of his argument structure. He has the following basic pattern that is repeated, I see it, in various and sometimes overlapping ways throughout the book. And I'll have to show that. I'll be documenting that. He begins with a core similarities, differences, conditional argument.
Where are you, Pastor?
I'm on page 2, halfway down, just past the little footnote 4. Little footnote number, not at the bottom of the page.
Okay, got it.
He begins with a core similarities, differences, conditional argument. That's that modus ponens one up there. To this argument, he adds a conditional predictions argument. And then he also adds a disjunctive reductio argument. Now, all that is saying is this, the disjunctive reductio argument, it's Christianity, it's evolution, and I'll call it naturalistic, or Christianity, it's not Christianity, how do we know? By reductio absurdities. So therefore, it's naturalistic evolution. That's what's true. That's all he's doing. I mean, he does this over and over again in the book. And how he does this, what we'll be looking at. So he has three, just to say it now another way, he has three ways of arguing. I call it a similarities differences argument, a predictions argument, and then a either or argument. Say those three ways. This is what I see looking through the whole book, and I'm going to keep testing myself as I keep going back through it. I think he has these three basic arguments. He sometimes will use them all in the same area, like under fossils, as the fossils category, all three will come up. Other places he'll use one, and then he'll use one with another, or he'll mix them up. They're overlapping, but these are the three patterns of argument that work the case, drive his case philosophically. What he's doing in the terms of the logic of it. Now, to be sure, I have here. We have to dabble a bit in science just as Coyne dabbles a bit in theology, but our goal is to examine philosophically how he grounds his why of evolution. If the three lines of argument do not hold as valid, then Coyne's claim that evolution is true is false. Before we begin our evaluation, we should give an example that reveals Coyne's threefold argument structure and how it works. His comments about the evolutionary tree of vertebrates fits the bill. And that's what I do on the next page. I just kind of show what he does. Now, I want to stop any comments on what we've done here, and maybe we'll stop there. I was hoping to get through those three. It's up to you what to do with any at this point. But any comments or up to this point? You see what I'm trying to do? Get the idea of what I'm trying to do in the in my critique or my analysis? And yes.
So I understand your goal is to examine philosophically, and this would be the evangelical philosophical EPS society, right?
Yes.
So your arguments, would they? Do you think that they would be acceptable within sort of the field of philosophy in general? Or
yeah, I do. Go ahead.
So not just as Christian philosophers,
no,
within that,
so.
With that area?
No.
Okay.
No.
And so the people, the philosophers, these Christian philosophers at this society, they would be not only analyzing you as, you know, your view as a kind of in terms of its Christian worldview, but based on pure philosophy.
Yeah.
Okay.
And some of them, they go way over my head. They get really technical. So I feel I use some of this language because I want to at least speak on their terms to some degree.
Right.
Are you trying to impress them?
No, I'm trying to understand them and have them understand me on terms like Jonathan's saying that are the technicalities of the discipline.
Yep.
And I think we need a rigorous logic in what we do.
Yeah.
And Coyne needs it too.
But ultimately, though, it will be impressive that you can handle these things comfortably.
I'm getting there. I don't know if I'm totally there yet on comfort level.
But you're over my pay grade. So I figure you're doing all right.
This is way over
your head.
I mean, what was that word you used? Tickle-licka-licka? Tickle-licka-licka?
A tick-the-lick. I'm not even sure the pronunciation of a lot of these words. I have to admit. It's T-I-K-L-A-A-L-I-K. And I'm just saying tick-the-lick. I don't know if there's some way you do the double A's in there. I don't know. Anybody know how they might pronounce that? But a fossil that fits between a fish and a tetrapod. And I'm not sure what a tetrapod is exactly, or an amphibian. You know, you know how evolution works. You've got, you know, if you have fish and then you have animals if fish live in water, you have animals that live in water and live on land, and you have some animals that live more in water than land, and others that live more on land than water, and then you have animals that live on land.
Yeah.
So there's the evolution. So you want to find that in a fossil record. Well, the tick-the-lick is one of those transitional forms, like the missing links that they've all been looking for.
Yeah.
Is
that's
it?
What that is.
Okay.
It's a missing link in the fossil record.
So that must be what my brother-in-law refers to when I tell him that the fossil record is empty of transitional forms. And he says, oh, no, not quite.
Exactly.
So
I would say exactly.
Must be referring to that.
They would say there's all kinds of these, he puts missing links in quotes, they're transitional forms.
Right.
Does he even have, human remains that are trans?
She identifies them too. It's interesting that he goes, he has the fossils as one of the most important areas that has really developed evolutionary science. It's like chapter 3. And then he lays out a lot of evidence. He doesn't get to, I think, to humans, our evolution, to like chapter 8. So he proves that naturalistic evolution is true before he ever gets to human evolution.
Like a Neanderthal or whatever?
Yeah, and all those, yeah. So yeah. When he brings them up, he's got all that already in place, and then he cites a number of different transitional forms, Neanderthal, and I can't pronounce some of these different ones. So, but I like to like use the one, the Lucy.
How about the Piltdown Man?
Piltdown Man, and well, you know, they're different. They're hoaxes. He'll identify that they were hoaxes. You know, where people hid the truth and fabricated things, and he says, "Yeah, we see that that was a hoax, but we have these others that are, they're not hoaxes." Yeah. You know, so you know, but yeah, that's the transitional forms. You know, the idea is just to be something. Just come to my mind and think about this. You don't look for behind the human species. You don't look for the human descendant. The human is a descendant of an ape, but the human is a descendant of what the ape is also a descendant of, an ape-like something. So it's an ape-like something that branched out to ape and human. And then, therefore, you're only going to see, like, you're going to find missing links are going to be more like the cousins. You're never going to find the nodes on the evolutionary tree. But you'll find cousins. And so they identify all the cousins as missing links. And,
you know, what's interesting
and
about
that's what that Tiktaalik is one. It's like an in-between. So they show certain things about these animals and this fossil related to fish and related to tetrapods. And you say, you can see that it's in between. You know, it's a transition from one to the other for his analysis. So I'll go into some of that more.
You know what's interesting about that argument is that it's purely speculative. I mean, when he says this and this, and he's trying to say, well, we're looking for something that is the father of ape and men. I mean, that's just grasping at trying to make sense of it all, isn't it?
I think he has arguments, so we got to test them. I mean, I think it's more than speculation because there are arguments.
Oh.
So that's all I would say about that for right now. Okay. I think it's gone too long. I would like to have gotten to the next, but we'll pick up there. What I'll do next time, you see, is I know this is going to be, some of you are probably less patient with this than others. Some of you are more interested than others. So if you all could just be patient with me on it. And if we get enough of a vote that you don't want to do this, just let me know.
But, should we form a committee and do a study on it?
On whether we're going to do this or not? Well, we'll be past the end of the month. I only got two more Sundays left, so.
It shoots the committee.
Well, just let me know who don't like it.
All right. There you go. Thank you for your patience with us. So.
Yeah, so just let me know.